Welcome to Health Cetera in the Catskills on WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains. Congress passed a bill last year, and President Trump signed it in July, that requires people on Medicaid to meet certain work requirements or lose their coverage. Several states had already put such a rule in place, and one would think that Congress and the president would pay attention to the experiences these states had. Well, Georgia is one state that did put this work requirement into place. And Dr. Blake McGee, a registered nurse and associate professor at Augusta University, has studied that state's experience. He's also a fellow in the Betty Irene Moore Fellowship for Nurse Leaders and Innovators at the University of California at Davis. And it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Blake McGee to Health Cetera in the Catskills. Thank you so much for joining me today, Blake.
Thank you very much, Diana. It's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about, give sort of the high level of Georgia's work requirement for Medicaid. When did this come about, and what was required in this state?
Certainly. So Georgia's Medicaid work requirement started in 2023, so we've been at it for about 3 years now. Previously, Georgia didn't have any Medicaid options for most adults under the poverty level unless they were elderly, disabled, or pregnant, because it was one of the 10 states that had chosen not to expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act. So instead, at that time, the state proposed a new program for this group of folks and called it Pathways to Coverage, which requires new applicants and enrolled people to work at least 80 hours a month without going over the poverty level, to go to school full-time, or to do another qualifying activity like community service. And more recently, caregiving for a child under six was added to that list of activities. It did not change requirements for people already on Medicaid in Georgia. So that is one of the main reasons that it survived litigation, unlike previous work requirements, especially in Arkansas, which had been struck down in court.
I didn't realize that. So Georgia's work requirement was only for people who are newly enrolled starting in 2023 in Medicaid. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's right. Previously, because we had not expanded Medicaid to low-income adults, adults under the poverty level in that, quote, working age population, right, of 19 to 64 years old, there wasn't really a public insurance option unless you were permanently disabled or pregnant or postpartum. And so that was the rationale for the program, as I understand it, to be allowed to remain intact by the court, because it wasn't, quote, kicking anyone off Medicaid at that time, although it has since then, but rather it was a new opportunity for some people, at least, to gain coverage.
So you decided to take a look at the impact of this on the state and on people on Medicaid or who wanted to get on Medicaid. Why did you decide to look at this?
We recently had a participant ask us the same thing. So I became interested in it because I had already conducted two prior studies focused on Medicaid expansion. For example, we found our team that stroke survivors in expansion states had an increase in the chance of being discharged to a skilled nursing facility and receiving rehab instead of just getting sent straight home from the hospital. And I also knew from my own family how dangerous it can be to go without health insurance and how scary and disruptive it is when the state threatens to terminate your coverage. Mm. But I also knew that Medicaid expansion is not a panacea. It doesn't fix everything. And I knew that it was politically unlikely in Georgia in the short term. So when Georgia Pathways came out, I was really intrigued. I thought it could be a politically viable option to cover some of the hundreds of thousands of people going without coverage. But I also had questions. For example, from the beginning, it was clear that requiring people to work at least 80 hours a month to qualify for coverage, but then terminating their coverage if they worked enough to earn above the poverty level, yeah, that would be a very fine needle to thread for some people. I also saw that because the program had been upheld in court, I could already see that other states were likely to want to copy it. And you mentioned the Moore Fellowship at the top, which I'm grateful for. And when I had the opportunity to pitch a research project as part of my application for that, this topic is immediately what came to my mind.
Yeah. And we should just clarify that prior to the Affordable Care Act, for the most part, single men were unable to get onto Medicaid. And under the Affordable Care Act, they did become eligible if the state chose to opt into that. And some states did not. In New York, we did. But Georgia, and there are a handful of some other states that did not, mostly Republican states. So let's talk about how you approached looking at the impact of this Georgia's work requirement in Medicaid. How did you approach this study?
Certainly. So, well, thanks to funding from the Moore Foundation and UC Davis, we've been leveraging publicly available data sets. For example, enrollment data from the state, some of which our partners at the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute have had to have requested through open records requests. And in addition, we have looked at a comparison group of uninsured folks in the same age and income bracket, utilizing census data and other public data sets. We're also looking at a National Health Survey called MEPS to understand differences in healthcare use between pathways, people who've been enrolled in pathways compared to people of similar ages and incomes who are uninsured. And then also we're doing some in-depth interviews all around the state to understand people's experiences in their own words. So we are looking at, we are interviewing folks, as I said, who've been enrolled in pathways before, as well as service professionals like enrollment assisters or navigators or others who work with community organizations that partner with the state to help people apply for Medicaid and other benefits, and what they've observed and what their experiences have been supporting people to navigate pathways and the work requirement in Georgia.
So let's talk about what you found.
Well, our study is still ongoing. We've got about 6 more months of data collection, and then we'll be reporting out more formally. But we've got some preliminary findings already, so some hot off the press that your listeners will be among the first to hear.
Good. Breaking news. I love
breaking
it.
Breaking news. There we are. Yep. Our early results show that pathways, according to the data that we've analyzed, has substantially under-enrolled Latinos, men, even more than would be expected, and older middle-aged adults, so people in that 50 to 64 age range versus younger adults. And this is as compared to what the target uninsured population looks like, so that same age and income group that would be eligible for pathways. So we have concerns about how equitably and evenly people are getting enrolled in pathways and what that may mean for other states, which I'm sure we'll come to in a minute. But most pathways enrollees that have been younger and female, we've also seen that a large proportion, actually larger than the proportion in the uninsured population, are Black or African American. And we're also learning a lot already from the interviews we've conducted so far. So there's a real mix of experiences, but just a few briefly of the challenges have included fluctuating hours at low-wage jobs, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to, or the nature of seasonal work. So you may hit 80 hours one month, but not in another. Getting too sick to work enough of hours to stay qualified or to stay in school full-time. Healthcare providers not accepting one of the three plans that administer Georgia Pathways benefits. So there are three different care management organizations that have three different provider networks that contract with the state to administer Medicaid in Georgia. And then there's also a lack of exemptions for things like family caregiving, especially in the beginning, but also that has continued to be a source of difficulty for some people to maintain coverage. And the last thing I'll say that that has been interesting to observe and hear about is that some people are cobbling together two or more activities. So they might be a part-time student, but then they need a part-time job or up their hours at their part-time job to qualify for Pathways. Or they may be working maybe about, I know, 12, 15 hours a week, but not enough. They're not getting enough hours to get to that 80. So then they're having to look at, well, would the volunteer time that I put in at my church qualify? Could I enroll in something in a local school that would count as half time? And so they're kind of cobbling together things to, especially for people with chronic conditions or who are really concerned about maintaining coverage in order to qualify or stay qualified at renewal.
So let me just ask you a couple questions about this. For people who are frail, who are disabled, so what kind of, are they not exempt?
It is, that's mostly correct, yes. So we do not, in Georgia Pathways, we have not had any long-term mandatory exemptions, unlike what you see in HR 1, but we have had a couple of what might be thought of as exemptions, like I mentioned earlier, caregiving for a child under six. In 2025, that was added as a qualifying activity. there's also a limited number of family caregivers who are paid through a certain type of certified program who can qualify based on that as an activity, but they're not exempt per se in the Georgia Pathways version of this program. And then if you were, if you had a permanent long-term disability that qualified you for another type of Medicaid, then you would also not qualify for Pathways because you would be qualified for a different type of Medicaid. But no, in general, people with caregiving responsibilities or disabilities that don't meet that threshold have not been exempt from the Pathways requirement.
So there are people out there who should qualify for Medicaid who now are uninsured because they are uninsured because they're not qualifying because they don't meet the work requirements. Is that right?
I think if I understand you correctly, you're asking if there are people who are out there who do qualify,
but are not getting
enrolled. Yes, that's right. And so we've seen that elsewhere as well. But one of the challenges has been, and that people are noting in the interviews when we talk to them, is this issue with what we'll call, or what sometimes gets called administrative burden. Mm-hmm. But what that means is I'm trying to upload my documents to show that I'm working, like my pay stubs, but the website's down or it's glitchy and I can't, you know, figure out, I get paper pay stubs and I can't figure out how to upload them from my phone. Yeah. Or they may have transportation difficulties getting to a county DFACS office. DFACS is Department of Family and Children Services here, to apply on paper or in person. Or they may not be able to get anyone. This is a frequent thing we hear, that they can't get anyone on the phone, or if they have a number for a specific caseworker, they don't get called back. It's things like that, not getting somebody on the phone, missing a document because the website was down, or that you didn't know that you needed it. Maybe you're a college student and you don't get your mail right away because you don't live with your family, or maybe you've moved and your mail hasn't been forwarded. All these sorts of reasons that are very relevant to real people's daily lives are very much a part of why people are getting terminated even from coverage, even if they are actually working and meeting the requirements.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I want to talk quickly about another kind of administrative burden, and that is the administrative burden cost to the state of doing all of this extra paperwork and the processing and the churn, et cetera. What do you know about how it's worked out for the state as a whole in terms of cost and administration of the program?
Well, for that, I would definitely refer your listeners or anyone interested to a couple of excellent reports that have been put out by the Georgia Budget and Policy Institute, or GBPI, and they've been close partners with us on this project. And what they found is that Pathways has cost taxpayers about $110 million after the first 2 years alone. And that the healthcare benefits piece of it, like actually paying for medical care, has accounted for less than $1 of every $3 spent, because the rest of that money is going to things like the administration of the program, the infrastructure needed to set up these complex applications, to do the regular verifications, and so forth.
And to your knowledge, Blake, are you uncovering any fraud around Medicaid? Is there really a legitimate article in this argument in the state that this is necessary because there's so much fraud, people on Medicaid who should not be on Medicaid?
No, on the contrary, I think that, again, this was a program that was newly offered to a population that previously didn't have a lot of coverage options. And so the burden of proof has really been on participants to show that they're meeting these requirements. It's much more often the case that people who are working or going to school or doing other qualifying things like caregiving, community service, volunteer work are actually doing those things and not able to get their application processed and accepted. And on the contrary, I think what we've seen nationally is that there is fraud in Medicaid, it's much more happening on the healthcare provider side than it is happening from individual working people. And I would just point briefly to research from Arkansas, which we might talk about.
Yes.
A study in Arkansas did find that 95% of the people who got disenrolled there after they experimented with a work requirement back in 2018 were already meeting the work requirement or should have qualified for an exemption there.
Yeah, and so Arkansas has some experience with it, and I believe Nebraska, do I have that right?
Well, so Arkansas has had experience with it previously.
Yeah.
Back in 2019, somewhere thereabouts, just before the pandemic, for about 9 months, they had a work requirement in effect for their Medicaid expansion program before a federal judge halted it. Mm-hmm. Nebraska more recently has, and Arkansas may have done this too, I'm not sure, but I can speak to Nebraska, has this go-around been an early adopter of the work requirements and the reporting that goes along with it under H.R. 1, which all states with Medicaid expansion will have to comply with by 2027.
And so because Georgia's not a Medicaid expansion state, it would not have to comply with that.
We do, actually, for reasons that I think may be clear to others but are still a little fuzzy to me. But yes, because Georgia and I believe Wisconsin, although I don't want to speak to that without knowing for sure, but certainly in Georgia, there is the state is moving to align its Pathways work requirements with what's coming in H.R. 1. So even though it's not technically Medicaid expansion, even though we don't get the enhanced federal matching dollars for Medicaid expansion on the basis of that, we have been told, I believe, by, we are moving toward, the state is moving toward complying and aligning the work requirements with H.R. 1 anyway. And there is actually currently the comment period just closed on the Georgia Department of Community Health essentially proposed regulation, or what they call public notice here, on how it's going to implement the community engagement requirement in Medicaid.
Great. So as I opened the program with, HR1 is requiring that states do this work requirement with Medicaid, and it's sort of stunning when you think that it may take away healthcare coverage from people who really need it, and also that it may actually cost more to operate. The other point in another program that I did on this was to point out that one of the cuts in Medicaid is cuts in administering Medicaid by the states. Mm-hmm. So it's really putting more of a burden on the states to cover those administrative costs, which can be quite burdensome, as you've just outlined for the state of Georgia. So what do you think the lessons are for us nationally at this point? And are there things that we should be paying attention to and monitoring?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so of course, my study does suddenly have this national relevance, whether I had wanted it to or not. So what I'll share, of course, is based on my own opinion, based on my expertise and on the data. But the main thing I would say we should be paying attention to nationally, based on the Georgia experience and the experience of Arkansas and others, is this disenrollment. So as I mentioned, Georgia Pathways was a new program in 2023, so it didn't kick anyone off at first, though it has since then. But because HR1 applies to people already on Medicaid, many, many people we anticipate will lose coverage. And what we've seen in Georgia suggests that those coverage losses may be felt differently by different groups of people. I'm particularly concerned about Latinos and older middle-aged adults. What we know also from Georgia, like you were talking about just there with administrative reasons, is that many of these terminations will be like, because of missing a document or the website is down, you can't get a caseworker on the phone, not because people aren't working. And finally, I'll add that I think that states are doing, but states are doing things a bit differently to the extent that they have latitude within the law. So some are requiring people to show that you met the 80 hours for the past 3 months instead of just 1 month. Mm-hmm. Some are not opting into the optional hardship exceptions, like for counties with natural disasters or emergencies that have been declared, or counties with very high unemployment rates, more than 50% above the national average. Those are optional exemptions for states. And I will say there will probably be at least 50 different definitions of the medical frailty exemption based on what we're seeing so far. So there is an exemption in HR1 for medical frailty or other special medical conditions, but it has yet to be seen, even in the proposed regulations, how that will really play out in actual practice, and I think it will vary a lot from state to state.
So it's up to the states to evaluate that, to set the standards?
Essentially, yes, because the federal regulation that came out was a bit circular, if I may say, insofar as it defined medical frailty as an exemption to the community engagement requirement as it set forth in HR1, but it said that a condition is only qualifies for the exemption if it interferes with somebody's ability to meet the community engagement requirement. So a lot of that burden will be left to states to develop policies and processes to figure that out.
Blake, if people would like to learn more about your work, how can they do so?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for asking. So I think you can follow me on LinkedIn, of course. I'm there at Blake Tyler McGee.
MC capital GEE.
Yes, and if you search my whole name, you will find me. Tyler is my middle name, but even if you just search Blake McGee, maybe at Georgia or Augusta University, you'll find me there. And I post about some of my work there and some of what I've done in the past. But also, there's the university, Augusta University, has an expert center page. It's augusta.edu/experts, and you can search my name there and find a bit more about me. And then finally, if you're interested in the study or know somebody who might qualify, the study website is at trialfacts.com. That's facts, F-A-C-T-S, www.ncpsychiatrist.com, and then you can click participate, view current trials, and then just search for the term pathways, and you'll find us.
Great. Well, that is Dr. Blake McGee, a registered nurse and associate professor of nursing at Augusta University in Georgia. He's also been a fellow in the Betty Irene Moore Fellowship for Nurse Leaders and Innovators at the University of California, Davis, which is how I know Blake, as I teach in that program. And he has been a pleasure to work with. And I have to say, Blake, I really appreciate the work you're doing. And wish you well. Thank you so much for coming on to Health Center in the Catskills today.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Take care, Diana.
All right. Have a great day.